To call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order, the time is 3:19 on Thursday, April 10th, and we're here in room 120. Please mute your cell phones today. Members present today include Representative McCabe, Representative Vance, Representative Holland, Representative Himshute, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Representative Carrick. Our record secretary is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juno LIO is Emma Turner. Mediate today is my staff, Stuart Relay. On today's agenda, we have three bills. We will start with public testimony on House Bill 104, the Address Confidentiality Program from Representative Mears, followed by public testimony on House Bill 139, Renting the Governor's Mansion from Representative Stapp. And then we will take up amendments for House Bill 16 on campaign contribution limits. So the first item on today's agenda today is public testimony on House Bill 104, the Address Confidentiality Program from Representative Mears. Before going to public testimony, are there any questions for the bill sponsor before we get started? No. Seeing none, we will open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 104? Welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the state coalition of 24 domestic violence sexual assault response service providers. We support House Bill 104 and appreciate Representative Mears bringing the issue forward. Address confidentiality programs are designed to safeguard the safety and well-being of individuals by preventing their actual addresses from being exposed in public records or to potential abusers. They act as a shield to prevent perpetrators from finding and continuing to harm their victims. Violence frequently escalates when people who choose to cause harm believe they're losing control of the victim. One of the most dangerous times is when the victim attempts to leave. They are at much greater risk of serious injury or death. If victims are successful in escaping, the person causing harm will usually focus their energy on finding the victim, stalking them, often searching public records, including voter registration and driver's license rolls. The bill allows the department to set standards in addition to protective orders when making enrollment decisions. There are times and situations where protective orders are not in the best interest of the victim. When lethality is particularly high and providing information through the protective order is considered placing the victim at greater risk. In such situations, it'll be even more beneficial to allow the victim to enroll in the address confidentiality program. Will it be used frequently? I think it will be used occasionally when the circumstances are extreme, the danger real, and secrecy is critical to a victim's survival. Stalking can include tactics like sending unwanted letters or emails, following or spying on the victim, driving by or waiting around at places frequented by the victim, such as home, work, or school, leaving or sending unwanted items, presents, or flowers for the victim to find, and looking through the victim's property, such as trash cans, mail, or cars. Stalking increases the risk of intimate partner homicide by 3 times. Among female victims of attempted and completed intimate partner homicide by male partners in the 12 months prior to an attack, 85% of attempted and 76% of completed homicide victims were stalked. The Address Confidentiality Program will allow for more enhanced safety options for survivors, and we expect will save lives. Thank you for taking testimony today and your thoughtful consideration in moving the bill forward.
Thank you very much, Ms. Morton, for your testimony, and we really appreciate you being here with us.
Thank you.
We're going to go to Maddie Cole in Juneau.
Hi, thank you. My name is actually Mandy Cole, and I'm the executive director at AWARE in Juneau. We've been providing domestic violence sexual assault services to survivors in Southeast Alaska for over 45 years. And this year is actually my 20th year at AWARE, so I've had a lot of time to think about issues like confidentiality and what measures are really protective for survivors. And I want to just mention there are lots of ways to contact or find a person, given how connected many of us are, social media, phones, etc. And you might not think that a confidential address is a big deal nowadays, but I've had a few experiences, one that broke my heart and one that scared me very, very seriously, that I think might be helpful as you're weighing the pros and cons of this bill. One was a mother who had recently gotten custody of her child from the father, and it took years, and it was a terribly long, difficult time for this family, and she had just gotten custody back, and she started to notice people driving by, taking pictures, people she didn't know started showing up. She was afraid that someone would try and lure the kiddo out, and the protection order, you know, served to keep away the person, her abuser, but it can't always keep their associates away. And so, you know, she lived every day kind of fearing that her kid might just innocently open the door to someone who wanted to take them. And we ended up helping them move quietly, and in their new location, they could relax. But this is an example of, you know, we have some things that may protect you from an offender, but that offender may share that information with someone else, and they may also know your address. And then the second story was just kind of a heartbreaking one that a survivor told me. She had, you know, I met her as an older person, and she had separated from an abuser a very long time ago. And she was coming to me because she had some communication with him that demanded something from her out of the blue. She's told me this story that even though the worst of it had happened 30 years ago, every few years he decided to harass her by starting something up. And if this bill passes, she might still have to receive mail. She might still receive mail from her ex of 30 years, but at least he wouldn't have her physical address, and his intimidation tactics wouldn't be able to include knowing where she lives. So I thought those two things might be helpful as you're thinking about address confidentiality, and I appreciate very much giving me some time to talk to you today, and on behalf of survivors, I do urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Mandy Cole. Sorry, I mispronounced your name earlier. Thank you for testifying. And it looks like finally online we have Derek Bose from Juneau.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. I would just like to introduce myself. My name is Derek Fox. I serve as the Chief of Police for the City and Borough of Juneau. I appreciate you allowing me the time to speak before you today. I am testifying in favor of House Bill 104, which creates an address protection program for survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, peace officers, and correctional officers and their families within the state of Alaska. As a law enforcement officer, I have witnessed firsthand the trauma sustained by victims of sexual assault and domestic violence. That trauma is only exacerbated when they are stalked, harassed, and continually targeted by the offenders who initially assaulted them. Address confidentiality protects those individuals from further victimization. Further, law enforcement officers are frequently the target of unwanted harassment, stalking, and physical retaliation by offenders, offenders' families, or arbitrary members of the public who are simply angry with law enforcement. As a law enforcement officer, I personally have experienced this. There have been multiple occasions throughout my career where I have been targeted at my home by offenders whom I have arrested. There have been other occasions where random members of the public have targeted me because they're angry with law enforcement in general and have come to my home intent on causing me physical harm. Far worse, there have been occasions in which my family has been confronted by dangerous individuals at our home who are intent on causing my family harm simply because they are associated with a law enforcement officer. I would also like to highlight the 2013 assassination of the Colorado Department of Corrections Executive Director Tom Clemens, who was targeted by a prison gang and murdered at his home in the presence of his family because of his position. Address confidentiality could easily have mitigated that situation. In closing, I would like to state that from a law enforcement officer's perspective, House Bill 104 is a pivotal for supporting the safety of our survivors and victims of sexual abuse, domestic violence, as well as essential for enhancing the safety of our law enforcement and correctional officers who protect our community day in and day out. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak before you today.
Thank you, Mr. Bose, and thank you for the work that you do as Chief of Police here in Juneau. Is there anybody else online or in the room who wishes to testify on House Bill 104? Seeing none, we are going to close public testimony on House Bill 104, and we will be setting this legislation aside for a future hearing next week. We are also setting an amendment deadline for House Bill 104 for Monday, April 14th at 5 p.m. So at this time, we will set this bill aside. The second item on the agenda today is public testimony for House Bill 139, renting the governor's mansion from Representative Stapp. Before we go to public testimony, is there any additional discussion on this bill right now? Seeing none, we will go to public testimony and open public testimony in House Bill 139. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 139? Seeing none, there is also no one online to testify, so we will go ahead and close public testimony. And at this time, we will also be setting House Bill 139 aside for a future hearing. I am setting an amendment deadline on this bill as well, also for Monday, April 14th at 5 p.m. So at this time, we will set House Bill 139 aside as well. And the final item on today's agenda is consideration of amendments on House Bill 16, campaign contribution limits, from Representative Schrage, who will be up in the House Finance Committee that was delayed today. Before we get into amendments, are there any initial, well, we don't have our bill sponsor here, so I think we'll skip questions. I will note for the committee, as we go through amendments today, we do have a couple of people online potentially for questions. Heather Hebden from the Alaska Public Offices Commission, and two volunteers, Frank Box and Beverly Churchill from Move to Amend. They're both volunteers. So we will hop right into amendments. At our hearing on Saturday, March 29th, I set an amendment deadline for House Bill 16 of Monday, April 7th at 5 p.m., and we received 11 amendments on this bill. Please refer to the amendment numbers as designated in the packet and by their top right-hand corner, A dot numbers as well. And we are going to take them up just very slightly out of order due to time constraints for one of our members here. And we're going to start with I'm pulling it up right now. Amendment number 8, also known as A.15. I'm going to turn to Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, Chair Carrick. I'm moving Amendment 8 at this time, and I will be also making a conceptual amendment to it when it's appropriate.
Okay. Well, I'll first object for discussion on the amendment, and if you'd like to speak to the amendment and then potentially offer your conceptual amendment.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. So Amendment 8 was offered in order to try and clarify the effectivity of the new campaign limits. It was offered with an intent to clarify the effectivity so that as the campaigns start for this next 2026 cycle, which actually would begin May 3rd, that it would clarify how this bill and its limits would be interpreted. I would at this point like to move conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment 8.
And we're going to take just a very brief at ease. So House State Affairs is back on the record. We wanted to distribute that conceptual amendment. And Representative Holland, could you please state that conceptual amendment again?
Great. Thank you, Chair Carrick. This amendment is an amendment to Amendment 8. So at page 1, line 7 to 15, we would delete all the material and insert at page 3, following line 22, insert section 10. This act takes effect immediately under AS 01-10070C.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Back on the record. Representative McCabe, did you want to restate that question?
Sure. So, yeah, I had a question on this amendment, a conceptual amendment. It looks like, because it says page 3 following line 22, that it amends the bill. But so maybe you could, the maker could explain that, and that would be helpful. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you. Through the chair. So conceptual amendment number 1 is making changes to amendment number 8. So it would remove, if you look at page 1 of amendment 8, it removes lines 7 to 15, essentially taking out the majority of the amendment that I was making, and inserts the language in amendment 8 that says page 3 following line 22 would insert this new language. So at the moment, we're just changing what amendment 8 says.
Thanks. Yeah, I think it's just the spacing on this, mm-hmm. the way this was spaced, it's confusing me. Which
confused
is
me
pretty,
too.
Pretty normal state of being for me, but
so I actually don't know that we did this before. I'm going to object to the conceptual amendment for discussion, so that we can discuss the conceptual amendment. On the conceptual amendment, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the sponsor and potentially the drafter. How does this conceptual amendment impact the contributions that are made for the 2026 election cycle for people who are already campaigning?
So through the chair, and if there's any support from the sponsor, it may be helpful. My understanding and my intent is that while my original amendment was making it retroactive to May 3rd, when the campaign season actually opens up, because this is under, you know, the APOC rules of statutes, May 3rd is the actual beginning of when campaign donations can be taken. We found out, and we had legal advice that says my original amendment was potentially going to create a problem constitutionally with freedom of speech and whatnot. So the intent with the conceptual amendment is that it would be effective at the point at which the act is effective, and it would not include any restriction on money between the effectivity of the bill when we passed it and back to May 3rd. So this first cycle, there'll be kind of a buffer of whatever was raised before the act came in that would be allowed, and then this will take effect from that point forward. And I don't know if the sponsor's staff has a clearer explanation than what I tried to offer. At the end of the day, I'm just trying to make sure this bill, when it gets enacted, is clear and effective and doesn't get tangled up because of ambiguity.
Ask Ms. Ndemo to potentially respond from Representative Shragi's office.
Yes, for the record, my name is Amanda Ndemo. Through the chair, Representative Vance, exactly what Representative Holland said, there were some concerns about the constitutionality of adding a retroactive date based on conversations with legal. So as of now, the point is to just make the effective date immediate upon passing.
Follow-up, Madam Chair? Yeah, thank you for that clarification. My concern is, how is APOC going to communicate this to people who maybe are just right on the trigger campaigning right away when the election cycle opens up, where they're following one set of rules, you know, at the start, and then depending on when this bill, you know, becomes law, right? It could be July. You know, how is APOC going to make communications to help people get up to speed on the limits of their campaigning activity?
Through the chair, I'd like to refer to Heather Hebden if she is on.
Ms. Hebden, did you hear that question?
For the chair, Representative Vance, I believe, let me restate what I believe the question was, is how would APOC communicate the changes to to these contribution limits in the middle of an election cycle. Is that correct?
Correct.
If there are changes in the middle of an election cycle, we would likely have to monitor campaigns as they are filing their letters of intent, registrations, and also filing with the Division of Elections and notifying them, each campaign, likely through email or letters to the campaigns, notifying them of the effective date that the campaign contributions went into effect.
Follow up. So, practically speaking, if the campaign cycle begins at the beginning of May, but the first reporting isn't due until right before the primary in August, this bill could become law in, for instance, July. I'm just thinking about the practical implications about that first report that is could have two different limitations on it, and how we are how would this law be applied to be fair to those people who are just trying to figure out what the law is, right? When you could have two different contribution limits on the one report. How I just want to make sure that what we do is practical. Can you help us walk through this or the bill sponsors?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, our intent is not to make it more complicated. Obviously, if the bill were to pass in July, the bill sponsor is not here right now, but we would hope for this to continue for the next election cycle.
If I can.
Representative Holland.
Great, thank you. I'd like to, through the chair, respond to Representative Vance's question in part also. So I think to help understand this, we need to back up to page 3, line 21, that has applicability that the act does not apply to contributions made to influence the outcome of the election that occurred before the effective date of this act. So all this does at the end with this conceptual amendment and then what I intend to be with final amendment is we're clarifying what the effective date is. And that was my underlying concern why I offered the original amendment was I thought and I was concerned that the language in the original bill left it undefined about the effectivity, and I thought it would lead to the same confusion that you're anticipating, that I also agree with you. This is going to be for this first year. It's going to be a little hard for campaigns to realize that we're changing the campaign rules. So I felt like the original bill might be clearer if we define what the effective date should be. Now, my original amendment suggested a retroactive date. That turned out to have more problems than solutions. So my conceptual amendment addresses this by simply clarifying that the act will be effective immediately. But line 21 and 22 provide some clarity for APOC in terms of how they will be dealing with this. But anybody dealing with a campaign will this first cycle, and I'm worried about this myself, it will be a little confusing, but I was trying to take a very small amount of that uncertainty out of the equation with this. And the intent behind doing this was that clarity, but this doesn't change the fact that we're going to be implementing this bill in the middle of an election cycle.
Let's see. I think I had put on the objection to the conceptual amendment. I'm going to remove my objection. Is there additional objection to the conceptual amendment? Seeing none, conceptual amendment 1 to amendment 8, A.15, has been adopted. And that brings us back to the underlying amendment number 8. Is there additional discussion on this amendment? Seeing none, I don't know who objected. I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection to amendment number 8? Seeing none, amendment number 8, also known as A.15, is adopted. And that will bring us back to amendment number 1, also known as A.3.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment 1, A.3.
And I'll object. Do you want to speak to your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this amendment limits non-residents' contributions and independent expenditures related to ballot propositions to $500 a year. This is specifically aimed at defending Alaska's right to control its own destiny. This amendment ensures that ballot propositions, whether initiatives, referendums, or constitutional amendments, reflect the will of Alaskans, not the agendas of non-residents with deep pockets. Why should someone from Seattle or San Francisco have unlimited sway over Alaska's future? Keeps our democratic process in the hands of those who live here and understand our way of life and who will be affected by the proposition. It protects local issues from out-of-state meddling. Ballot propositions often tackle Alaska-specific issues like resource development, taxes, or rural governance. Non-residents don't bear the consequences of these decisions, yet Alaskans do. This limits their influence to limiting their influence to $500 a year stops wealthy outsiders from hijacking our processes. It isn't about silencing speech, and this is very important. It's about ensuring our elections aren't drowned out by national activist groups or progressive billionaires who don't know the first thing about life in Anchorage or in the bush. And sometimes they even use us as an experiment because, frankly, and you've heard it before, we're a cheap date. They can influence our elections up here fairly cheaply compared to a state like California. This preserves the integrity of a direct democracy. We value a government accountable to its people. Ballot propositions are a sacred tool for Alaskans to directly shape our state, but unlimited non-resident money risks turning them into a pay-to-play system favoring outside interests. And our ballot proposition language is among the most liberal for constituents in the nation. We have more sway over the ballot propositions than many people in many states. A $500 cap levels the playing field, keeping the focus on Alaskan voices, our fishermen, oil workers, and small business owners, not some coastal elite's checkbook. This is a practical limit. It's not a ban. Amendment doesn't silence non-residents. It just sets a reasonable limit. They can still contribute or spend up to $500, which is enough to express an opinion without letting them dominate our process. Alaskans don't overregulate, and this is an overreach. It's a targeted safeguard to protect our unique direct democracy from being exploited by those who don't call this state home. The legal memo warns of First Amendment challenges, citing courts that say ballot measures don't involve corruption. But we know, as Alaskans, we know unelected judges don't always get it right, especially when it comes to our specific needs in our state. If the courts strike this down, we'll fight back, but we won't let fear of a lawsuit stop us from doing what's right. This is about principle. Alaskan elections should serve Alaskans, not national agendas. Most out-of-state cash flowing into the ballot fights come from groups that are pushing environmental extremism or big government policies that hurt our resource economy. This amendment helps shield Alaska values from that onslaught. It's a priority to keep our state free, prosperous, and independent. Limiting non-residents' influence on propositions like oil taxes or hunting rights is a step towards that goal. This amendment sends a message. Alaska is not for sale. Our ballot process isn't a sandbox for national PACs or wealthy ideologues to experiment with. It's for Alaskans to decide our future our way. I'm proud to back this bill and this amendment that puts Alaska first, protects our sovereignty, and keeps power where it belongs, with the people of this great state. That's my spiel, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. I really appreciate everything you just said, and I don't necessarily disagree that all of it is completely true. My concern with this amendment is that the Hebden decision, which was what struck down our previous contribution limits, was directly related to the out-of-state contributions. And I agree that the ruling that out-of-state donations can't be limited in that way is kind of ludicrous, but it is very tough to make those changes, and I wish it were an easier pathway forward to do that. Representative Himshute.
Yeah, I have the same concerns, and I was just going to ask if any states are able to do this kind of limitation. Isn't every state subject to the same ridiculous amounts of money coming in that we've seen?
Well, that's a good question. Through the chair, no, I'm not so sure. I don't know that that's true or not. And frankly, you know, we are the lawmakers, and a judge making a decision, it could go before another judge and make a different decision, right? So we are not saying you can't make a contribution. We changed it up a little bit from the Hebden decision and said you can make a contribution. It's just not going to be $500 million. It's going to be $5 million. So we have seen this issue most recently with ranked choice voting. Whether you agree with it or not, the playing field was not level. For the outside money was $12 million-ish dollars, and the people that were opposing ranked choice voting were able to raise a little over $100,000 to counteract that. So I think that all we are doing here is trying to level the playing field a little bit and let Alaskans decide their own destiny, not outside interest with respect to a ballot measure. I mean, think of it. If you put a ballot measure forward as a citizen, you wander around the state gathering 30, 40, 50,000 signatures. Somebody that's outside the state that has an agenda, or maybe they want to experiment with this state and see how it goes, because, as I said, we're a cheap date. They don't even have to gather any signatures. All they have to do is apply money. And that's very, very frustrating, and it should be frustrating to all of us. And I think we should, as legislators, as a legislative body, should push back at the courts and say, no, this is what Alaskans want. So,
I think my question is for the chair. I'm not sure what to do here because I'm concerned about the constitutionality of it, but I support it 100%, so I'm feeling a little stuck. Like, I couldn't agree more. I hate that outside money. I hate it. And it's, you know, not considered dark anymore because they have to put their name on, but their name could be three initials. So you still don't know, like NEA or, you know, whatever, NRA. So I hate the amount of money coming in, but I'm worried. I don't want to set us up for lawsuits either if this has already been decided. So I'm feeling a little bit stuck. If anybody has any additional information, because I really want to support this amendment, but I'm also very concerned about causing a lawsuit with, you know, more money going out to defend.
Representative Holland.
Great. And through the chair, I agree with the comments. I agree with the intent of what this amendment is doing. I would like to see this happen. But my first priority and the direction from constituents and, you know, almost a year of work is they want these campaign limits of House Bill 16 passed. So I'm going to lean on the side of making sure that this bill gets through without anything that might jeopardize it. And that was the reason that earlier amendment we discussed. My intent is only that this be clear, effective, unambiguous, and that it gets into law for this next campaign cycle. So I'd like to see this happen. I think it might need to be a separate bill or somehow disconnected. I will vote against this, not because I'm against the intent, but because I want to protect this bill and its effectiveness.
Thanks. So through the chair.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate it. So I would rather pass a law that defends our courts, or defends our state, and let the courts duke it out, frankly. And I will tell you that hopefully you have 21 on the other side, because without some of these amendments, conservative amendments, it will not pass.
I don't think we're supposed to reference
I'm sorry.
Future
but
executive
point,
action.
Point being, I mean, well, you can do that in committee. You just can't do it on the floor, I think. But the point being,
we're on the side of caution and not do that today.
The Alaska legislature is supposed to be a stronger branch than the courts. The courts, by design, by constitution, are supposed to be weaker. If you think of us in terms of strength, we don't pass laws based on what a legal analyst tells us they think the court might do. And I think our sovereignty justifies direct democracy from shielding ourselves from non-resident cash. That's our sovereignty as a state. That's our job as legislators. And if we're not doing it just based on a judge's decision that we think we might run afoul again, I think we fail to do our jobs, frankly. So $500 is fair. It's not a ban. It says you can still influence. If you can get 10 of your friends together, you can put in $5,000.
Just for committee members' information, we will, in a moment, take a brief at ease to get Ledger Legal online to ask a couple questions here. Representative Vance.
Thank you. I've seen the many renditions of this bill over the years and have been looking at, you know, different constitutional concerns and laws and court cases. And, you know, I appreciate Representative McCabe bringing this forward. I actually got a phone call today that my staff put on, you know, speakerphone, and the constituent said, at what point do we as the people get to determine the limits of this outside influence versus the courts telling us what we can and cannot allow in our state? And it's exactly what Representative McCabe said. You know, I understand that there could be the court's interpretation be, you know, to say that, no, we can't do this. However, I think we should take a stand, make a statement, because if it were to be challenged, the other areas of the bill would not be tossed out. It's not that they take the whole legislation. They can look at specific areas and say, this is where we have concern and question. And I think as the voice of the people, we need to push the envelope on this issue, because it doesn't matter, you know, what side of the issue it is. The sword cuts both ways. And Alaskans want to be the ones who determine our future. You know, I think about environmental groups going after Sitka last year, and it feels like we're being attacked by the courts and all these lawsuits at just an exponential rate. And when courts that are not even in Alaska make determinations about what we can do in our elections, you know, we need to make a stand. And being able to provide boundaries, I think, is healthy. Because we have family members who want to contribute, you know, to campaigns or something, who live outside, right? We don't want to prohibit that in any way, because, you know, our family loves us and wants to be supportive. So, you know, like Representative McCabe said, we're just providing a framework and a boundary. This is the type of thing that I want the courts to address. I want the legislature to make a statement about the direction that people want and not be afraid of whether it is taken up in a lawsuit. I think it's something that we want contended, but have the confidence that the other areas of the bill would be secure if they meet that constitutional scrutiny. So I understand, you know, the concern about making sure that areas get through, but my constituents have said, man, at what point do we as Alaskans get to determine our future ourselves by what we say and what we contribute? So I'm going to be supportive of this in the hopes that the courts do want to take it up and give us more direction based upon other jurisprudence, that we can then be able to find the right level of contribution. But I do look forward to what Ledge Legal has to say as they've looked at the different cases. But we are the lawmakers. The courts are not supposed to be making law. We are. They're supposed to be interpreting. But they can't interpret if we don't give them law that provides these boundaries.
I'm going to go to Vice Chair Story, and we do have Ledge Legal online, and then we'll go for the second round of questions.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I was just going to say, let's directly go to legal. We are here because Alaskans did have an initiative, and they directed us, the courts, they do have the say in that. And so we're back here doing this legislation, which I really want to get passed. And to me, it'd be better to bring it back in another bill. I don't want this to get struck down. I think that obviously we all agree we would love to see outside influences not influence our election, but we do have case law, and I think it's only if it's like a quid pro quo situation that under that court case you were referencing that it could not. This would fail because I don't. This is not one of those situations. Anyway, let's hear what Ledge Legal says.
Yeah, Alpheus Bullard from Legislative Legal is online, and I don't know how much of the discussion you've caught, but I guess there's two questions that have arisen from the committee thus far. One is, and please, committee members, correct me if I'm wrong. One is, would Amendment Number 1, also known as A.3, likely be struck down were it to be adopted and the legislation to pass by the courts? And my second question is just if you know, with the previous Hebden decision, why was it that the individual in-state contributions was also struck down? And could it not be possible to just strike down a portion of this legislation if this were to have the same ruling?
Good afternoon, Mrs. Alpheus Bullard of Ledge Legal. Are you able to hear me in the committee room?
We can, yes, thank you.
So in response to the chair's questions, I have been able to hear a good degree of the conversation, and I'll answer in the following way. Looking at Amendment 34-LF0217/A3, that the correct amendment?
That's correct.
We have two things going on. We have a prohibition, a limitation that's applicable to non-residents, and also that deals with invalid propositions. And the substance of this amendment would be struck down as unconstitutional by a court for two sort of overlapping reasons. And the first one has to do with non-residents and residents. And, you know, if we're going to limit people's political speech and contributions and independent expenditures that are a form of political speech, the state needs a compelling reason. And the remedy needs to be narrowly tailored because speech is a fundamental right. And in examining various campaign finance limitations, courts have found that non-residents are not a source of corruption. The chair mentioned the Hebden decision, and Hebden isn't completely on point because one of the problems in the Hebden decision was that our existing in the statute's limitation on non-resident contributions to candidates is what's called an aggregate limit, which means a candidate can only receive so many contributions from out of state. And when it comes to this sort of limitation, it's not even necessary to get to the fact that these contributions are non-residents. It's that it's an aggregate limitation. And then Hebden, the court said, why would a contribution that, you know, is allowed under the limit be less inclined to promote corruption than one that receives after the limit has passed? You know, this is not a narrowly tailored, solution. And so the state's existing aggregate limit was tossed out. But remember, the only rationale that survives for limiting contributions under our Supreme Court's holding, not a Ninth Circuit court or an Alaska court, at the United States Supreme Court, is quid pro quo corruption. And non-residents aren't a greater evil than residents when it comes to the possibility for corruption. The people of Louisiana or Maryland or you know, no more or less corrupt than the people of this state. And so sort of limitations based on residency are out. That is not constitutional. But in this instance, it's even more egregious because this has to do with ballot propositions. And with ballot propositions, there's no candidate. There's no one who can, you know, reward people for contributing to them. And so there's no real possibility of quid pro quo corruption at all, whether it be from residents or non-residents. And so for those reasons, the substance of this particular amendment would be found unconstitutional.
Okay, thank you for that. I had a queue going. Hemshoot stepped out, so we'll go to Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Alpheus, how long ago was the, through the chair, how long ago was the Hebden decision?
I think the Hebden decision was 2002. Let's see. I mean, which of the Hebden, the most recent Hebden decision was 2002.
So, I'm sorry, 2002, is that what you said? It's a little bit fuzzy, so.
Forgive me. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I believe that had been was decided in 2002.
Okay, through the follow-up. So you're saying that unequivocally a court or the Supreme Court would strike this down out of hand without taking it to court. You can say that just as an attorney or you know, I'm a little confused as why we are bowing to the courts when we are the legislative body, and the courts would use our testimony here in any kind of a court case. Is that not correct?
Through the chair, may I offer a correction?
Yes, Ms. Ndemo.
So the most recent Thompson v. Hebden case was decided in 2021. Are we discussing the same case?
I believe that was the case that I was referring to earlier. Alpheus's job too is not necessarily to understand every piece of case law. Are you aware of a case from 2021, Thomas v. Hebden, Mr. Bullard?
Through the chair, this is Alpheus Bullard. Yes, I'm aware of the Thomas v. Hebden decision.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to go back to Representative Hemshoot. Oh.
Didn't really answer my question, but.
Okay. Well, do you have a follow-up question, Representative McCabe?
Thank you, through the chair. So, Alpheus, did you hear my question of a minute ago before Ms. Ndemo mentioned the date?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I did. And because I'm a lawyer, the answer that I would provide is I never know what a court is going to do. But I think the chances are excellent, given the vast body of case law from the Supreme Court on down, that this would be found unconstitutional because non-residents are not a source of quid pro quo corruption, and the ballot propositions don't really present the issue of quid pro quo corruption, and quid pro quo corruption is the only existing rationale for limited campaign contributions.
Thanks.
Now, Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Bullard. I just need to understand, if we were to pass this amendment and then this bill becomes law and this section is problematic with the courts, does the bill go into effect and later that section is challenged? Because at that point, once it's law, the things are no longer related to each other, right? So the bill could go into effect, and then at some point in the future, the court challenge would come. Am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, well, I defer to the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I imagine that the commission would get a recommendation from their attorneys not to enforce the statute if it were enacted.
Okay, thank you. Maybe through the chair, could we check with the APOC person? And it seems to me once the thing is a law, it's in effect until a section of it's challenged. Is that correct?
Ms. Hebden, did you hear the question?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question, please?
Thank you, through the chair. I just wanted to confirm with you, if we pass this bill with this amendment in it, the bill stands as law if it passes, and then a section of the bill can be challenged without necessarily the entire law being impacted.
Through the chair, Representative Hinshute, that is also my understanding of it.
Okay, thank you.
However, I should preface that there have been instances in the past where we have been advised by our Department of Law that we should not enforce specific provisions of the law due to constitutional concerns.
So, quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
If we were to pass this amendment, there's the chance you would not be allowed to enforce what we passed because Department of Law might have the same concerns that Mr. Bullard is expressing?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Representative McCabe.
I kind of feel a need to follow that up. So let me be clear with what you just said, Ms. Hebden. You said that if we, the legislature, the lawmaking body of this state, pass a law that says you will do this, you don't think that you have to do it? Is that kind of what you're saying? Just because the Department of Law tells you don't have to do it?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, what I said was there have been instances in the past where provisions we have been provided guidance through the Department of Law that has essentially precluded us, well, recommended that we not enforce provisions of the law due to changes of the legal landscape.
Well, we might as well go home.
Briefties. So House State Affairs Committee is back on the record. Thank you to our folks who are available for questions today and our bill sponsor staff. We are still under discussion on Amendment Number 1, and I'm going to maintain objection on this amendment. And again, it's not because I don't support the intent of the amendment. I think there are too many unanswered questions for me to feel comfortable accepting it right now. If there's a way for us to get some of these questions answered prior to the bill coming to the floor, I would potentially really like to see that and have some consultation with the bill sponsor as well. Is there further discussion on Amendment Number 1? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to get the public up to speed, I believe that this is a separation of powers issue that we are facing at, you know, with this dilemma. We have current jurisprudence that says that we have to have any limits that we put on free speech, we have to have a compelling reason to limit that free speech and prove how it leads to corruption. And as our legislative legal said, it must be narrowly limited. What hasn't been said on the record is that our most recent ballot measure, and we've had numerous ones, the most recent ballot measure that passed by less than 1% margin had outside contributions 92-1 of that of Alaska. I think that is a very compelling reason that the legislature should take action in making a statement about limiting the non-resident influence in our elections. I don't know if there is any corruption involved, but it definitely puts a question mark on why there would need to be that much outside influence into the state that completely changes the makeup of how we conduct our elections. We cannot ignore that. Now, I understand that there is several cases of jurisprudence that our legislative legal services believes that this may be tossed out at face value. But it is not something that we can ignore when we are working on legislation that limits campaign contributions, because Alaskans have said this is a big concern. So I do want to put that on the record that that is something that we are contending with and in trying to understand what we can do as the lawmaking branch to push the limits about what we feel is appropriate for the boundaries within the law. There are certain levels of scrutiny that have been mentioned that I think meets that requirement, but we need to have that on the legislative record because that's what the courts will look at. They'll look at the law as written, and they will go back to our legislative record and say, what did they feel was warranting this kind of change? In my mind, the most recent ballot measure is the one that reaches the highest threshold. We could go on and list many more that include that, but I think that one is the most recent in people's memory.
Thank you. Additional discussion? Seeing none, the objection is maintained. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Himshute.
Pass.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative Holland.
No.
Representative Himshute.
No.
Chair Carrick.
No.
3 yea, 4 nay.
And with a vote of 3 yeas, 4 nays, Amendment Number 1, also known as A.3, has not been adopted. That will bring us to Amendment Number 2, also known as A.4. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Amendment Number 2, A.4.
And object?
This one might be a little bit easier. Madam Chair, this amendment introduces simplified reporting forms for groups and non-group entities receiving less than $5,000 in annual contribution, and it exempts these entities from reporting contributions over 250 days when made within 9 days of the election. So what this does is cuts small red tape for small grassroots groups. It lets small groups and entities, those raising less than $5,000 a year, use simplified reporting forms, sparing them the crushing paperwork that big players can afford to handle. This is about fairness. Mom-and-pop campaigns in rural Alaska, Bush Alaska, shouldn't face the same red tape as the slick Juno PACs. And less bureaucracy means more freedom for regular Alaskans to engage. The exemption from reporting 250-plus contributions in the final 9 days of an election is a lifeline for small groups. These folks, usually local volunteers, not corporate folks, don't have armies of accountants to file last-minute reports. This amendment keeps them in the game without drowning them in compliance costs. If critics argue this hides money from voters, I would say that we're taking peanuts under $5,000 total. The real threat isn't the local fishing club's last-minute ad. It's the big spenders who still have to report. This isn't less transparency. It's smart prioritization. So this amendment empowers local voices. It champions the little guy, which is kind of what we're trying to do here, the voters, by easing reporting rules for small groups. We're helping community organizations, clubs, resource job advocates to get their message out without the government strangling them in forms. Our campaigns are not like New York's or California's. Our small towns and tight-knit groups shouldn't be crushed by rules built for bigger, larger campaigns. Think of a local election in a small community, Nenana or Healy or something, and you're just trying to elect a school board, and you have to all this reporting to do, and you just have a small group of families together that are trying to help one candidate or another. The simplified forms and reporting exemptions mean more Alaskans can participate in elections without fear of government penalties. Groups under $5,000 aren't bankrolling statewide campaigns. They're lucky to print a few signs. It's about trusting Alaskans, not assuming they're crooks. This amendment puts Alaska's small campaigns first, letting them focus on issues like jobs and freedom instead of compliance headaches. It's about keeping elections open to everyone, not just the well-funded. I think you'll see in every amendment that I have that I'm trying to focus on the everyday Alaskans. They're the ones that sent us down here. We're supposed to be working for them to get their voice heard, not working against or for the courts. And so that's why I brought this forward. Thanks.
Questions and discussion? Representative Hemshute?
Yeah, apologies to the chair. Could you give me examples of when you're talking about, so I ran for assembly, I raised less than 5,000, I didn't have to report anything. So, but this is more about groups. So what's an example of a group in a local election? I can't think of any in my town, but maybe I'm just not thinking about it clearly. Like, there was no group opposing me or supporting me. It was just me out there knocking on doors.
So, yeah, oftentimes in a small town, in a small election, Sitka would be probably one of them. If you have a group together, it's Rebecca Hemshute's neighbors or neighbors for Rebecca Hemshute, and it's a block of people on your block that want to get together and buy signs for you, and they form a small group or non-group, and they want to buy all these signs, and less than $5,000 they don't have to report. If they spend more than $5,000, which is not likely, then they would have to report, in my vision. So there have been groups in Big Lake that have put together flyers to put in mailboxes or mailers, and, you know, less than $5,000 they wouldn't have to report. But if they go over that, then they would. So, frankly, I'm sort of fighting for groups of people that opposed me last time. I'm serious. Sent out mailers and that sort of thing. Saying I'm this or I'm that or please oppose him. So that's what this does. It just relieves the reporting requirements.
Follow up. So. I thought there were no reporting requirements if it's under 5,000.
It's the simplified reporting forms for 5,000. There are still reporting requirements. Is that not correct?
There wasn't at the time I ran a few years ago for under 5,000, unless it's for groups. There is a requirement for groups. I was an individual. So then let's say this is for groups and groups have to report. And for example, in Sitka right now, there's a ballot initiative trying to limit cruise ships in Sitka. So if a group is spending money on yard signs and they spent more, that if that group raised more than $5,000, they would have to report, and that's what you want to simplified reporting forms for groups and non-group entities that receive less than $5,000. So they have to report because they're a group, even if it's under $5,000.
Correct.
Got it. And this would, so what does simplified mean?
So this, thanks, through the chair, this allows the APOC to develop the forms, just simplified forms that are one-liners. I mean, I don't really have an idea of a form. I didn't develop a form. I just, going into APOC and spending all the time, I can tell you right now that if my wife's hair wasn't already gray, it certainly would be at the end of this last session because she does my APOC. So, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I know, right?
That's love.
Yeah, right.
So through the chair, since I don't know what the forms are now, I'm having a hard time with this because I simply don't know what we're simplifying. But you've looked at these forms, and it's like pages and pages of them.
So I will.
Your wife hasn't reported to you.
Correct. Okay. Right.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wow, I wish that there was no. This is a very conservative change because it still requires reporting, but it's simpler than what it is now. I would just assume that they don't have to report at all. So for clarification, Representative Hemshute, my municipality is the same when I ran for city. If we spent less than $3,000, we did not have to report with APOC. However, groups do have to report. And recently on the peninsula, there was a hospital proposition on the borough for our area. And three men got together and wanted to oppose it. Literally three men. And they wanted to put out a flyer and radio ads. So they contacted someone who was familiar with APOC. They thought they were doing all the right things. And they put this flyer out. And it turns out that they got in trouble and got fined by APOC because they didn't report as a group about the activity that they were doing. And they thought that they had done all the right things. And so they had to hire an attorney and pay the attorney to go through APOC, do the reporting, pay the fines. And it was just literally three citizens that wanted to do a flyer and radio ads to oppose the large hospital-funded proposition. So I am in 100% of support of this because we want people to be active. We want them to engage on whatever level that they can. And by saying, hey, if you're spending under $5,000, you know, you're pretty limited. I mean, we all know how much signs and radio ads cost. That has been impacted by the cost of inflation as well. So I think it aligns with what our municipal limits are on not having to report. And I think this is just a very common sense thing that is going to allow people to not be intimidated by the process, because just getting through the APOC website itself and knowing what to do. So this does give a lot of latitude on what the word simplified is. So I think it would be helpful for the sponsor to specify what his intent is behind simplified. But my intent would be to limit it, the reporting forms to be as easy as possible. If they have to click more than five pages on APOC to get through it, it's too many. So the easier we can make it for people to actually engage in the process is what we want. We want people to be able to speak up.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Chair Carrick, the more important piece of this is the $250, more than $250 in the final 9 days. So right now, if you have those three fishermen down in Sitka that are banded together to support Rebecca Hemshoot for house next year, and they're all out fishing, and they get contributions, and they have to report. That's a big issue for a local group of volunteers. They don't have accountants. Maybe they don't have wives that are doing their APOC like I did, and they. So this places an unfair limit on these really small entities that are essentially just contributing peanuts to a campaign, and it's more focused on local Homer Sitka kind of elections. It's not necessarily focused on a big state election.
Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I see that we have APOC online. They're with us today, and it helped me to know the rationale for why they require groups and non-group entities that spend less than $5,000, because they do not require that for candidates who say we're not going to spend less than $5,000. And so it'd be helpful for me to know the history and the rationale for this.
Ms. Hebden, did you hear that question?
Through the chair, yes, I believe so. And I can't really speak to the rationale because I don't know the genesis of it, but there is a provision in our statutes that provides for a municipal candidate who intends to spend less than $5,000 to file as an exempt candidate. And it does exempt them from a reporting requirement for the entirety of the campaign, provided they don't exceed that $5,000 threshold. The exemption is not available for a state candidate, and it's not available for groups, although it was proposed in legislation in prior legislatures, but I don't believe it got any forward traction with that. But it was, I believe it was a provision that we had put forward that we thought it would be a good idea, because I would agree that there are many of these grassroots groups that what we typically see form to be involved with their local ballot measures. That's what we see the most. So they're passionate about it. It affects their communities. They want to be involved. They're not going to spend high dollar amounts, but yet they do still have to report all of their activity. And if it's people that aren't experienced, there is a certain learning curve to that. So I understand where this amendment is going. I'm not quite sure that Amendment 2 captures the will of the sponsor of the amendment, but I'm happy to work with Representative McCabe on fine-tuning this a little bit more.
Well, I guess, Ms. Hebden, that brings up a question for me. Is can you talk about what the reporting looks like right now, and if this amendment were to pass, what would you consider a simplified reporting form? What would potentially be omitted from that reporting form?
That's difficult for me to say. Currently, what is required is what is required for candidates or other groups. They have to disclose all of the contributions that they receive, as well as the expenditures that they make. During the 9 days, for the larger contribution, those in excess of $250, they're required to submit 24-hour reports disclosing those contributions. But they are also required to file independent expenditure reports, and those must be filed within 10 days of making an expenditure, or if it's in the 9 days preceding the election and more than $250, then they have to be reported within 24 hours. So it is a bit more complicated than a candidate's campaign, just because it does involve independent expenditure reporting in addition to the regular cyclical campaign disclosure reports.
Representative, I'll go to Vice Chair Story again, because we're kind of on the same track here.
Thank you. I'm just thinking about this, and I'm thinking about communities and different size communities, and thinking about information that different people have asked about who is funding this, who's not funding that. And in some ways, I think people do want to know for small groups, non-groups, independent expenditures, who are spending less than $5,000, maybe $4,500, who's doing it. They just want to know who is doing it. So I hear, yeah, so that's, I just wanted to make that comment on the record.
I mean, so as a clarification to Representative Story, they would still know, they would just have a quote-unquote simplified reporting process. And I, so they would still have to file with this amendment, but it would be a simplified process. And I guess I'm probably going to maintain my opposition on this amendment because I don't know what a simplified reporting process would look like, and I'm a little hesitant about what would potentially be omitted. Like, for example, it would be great for that reporting process to be easier, but if that comes at the cost of knowing what the address mailing information is of potential donors or supporters, that's the kind of information I think is really valuable, and I don't know that this, to Ms. Hebden's point, amendment creates the kind of clarity needed to understand what that would look like. I see Representative Himshut and then Holland.
Maybe.
Yeah, okay. Representative Himshut.
So I like this amendment. Where I'm struggling, though, is reporting forms when it sounds like it's the process that I want simplified. A 24-hour report for less than $5,000? Like, that to me, that just feels, so it's, I mean, maybe I need a conceptual amendment to simplify the process rather than the forms. I'm just trying to work through, for less than $5,000, I agree with Vice Chair Story. I want to know who's spending what. I want to know that. But I don't need a 24-hour report on something that's less than $5,000. So, and maybe I'll go ahead and put a question on here for Ms. Hebden. This is all governed because we have the same rules for IEs no matter how much money or how small the group. Is that why they have this reporting process?
For the chair, Representative Himshut, yes, that is correct. They are the same rules that apply across the board.
And Ms. Hebden, additional question. If we were to simply take this amendment and change the word forms to process, would that be, as you mentioned earlier, the kind of thing that would get more closely to the bill, to the amendment sponsor's intent?
Through the chair, Representative Himshut, I think that might be better answered by the sponsor. I'm not sure what he means by simplified reporting forms either. So I appreciate the concept. I just don't know what that looks like.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Chair Carrick, I appreciate the I'm happy with forms. I'm happy with process. It's my intent. It's not my intent to put into legislation a form that I expect, especially not because it's all electronic now. It's not my intent to put a form into legislation that they would have to follow. I fully understand that APOC develops regulations outside based on using statute and legislation for guidance, and I fully trust that Ms. Hebton could interpret this and figure out a simplified form. She knows, you know, would have to have, I'm sure would have to have name, address, and some possible way of doing this other than the reams and pages and time that it takes to go through this. Especially the 24-hour thing is extremely egregious for candidates.
Through the chair,
Representative Himshut.
What about expanding it to forms and processes? And I would be open to Ms. Hebden saying, "Oh, we're going to run afoul of something we have to do because it's an IE." But I'm looking at trying to meet the goal of the amendment to simplify things, and maybe it's a form that needs to be simplified, and maybe the best they can do to simplify it is take out one line, but maybe they could simplify the process and take off the 24-hour. But is that going to force APOC to go afoul of the rules we've given them for IEs? I guess that's my question.
Ms. Hebden?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, part of my conflict here with this proposed amendment is that it's coming in under 1513030, but the substance of what is actually reported on campaign disclosure reports lies in section 1513040. So that is all the information that is dictated must be reported by groups and candidates as well. So that goes to part of what I was saying about I understand where the amendment is going. I just don't think this amendment gets it there. Typically, what we see under AS 1513110 is the timing of the report, but not the substance of the report.
Chair Carrick,
does that make sense?
Could we consider tabling this amendment to a time certain, since we're going to run out of time today anyway for all the amendments? We know we're coming back to this. And if we table it, then when we pick it back up off the table, we could do conceptual amendments to it. I'm just wondering if that's a possible path forward.
Let's take a brief at ease really quick to discuss the committee process for this legislation today. House State Affairs back on the record. So we are now joined by Representative Shragi in the room, and we are still under discussion on amendment number 2. Just to briefly summarize, we had a conversation on the record a few minutes ago with Legislative Legal and APOC regarding the wording of this amendment. And are there any additional comments or discussion on amendment number 2? Representative Holt.
Yeah, just through the chair, the amendment, I think, you know, makes some, I guess I agree with the intent of it, although if we figure that this is $5,000 a year, this is a $10,000 group that is now allowed to drop a payment within, 9 days of the election, and be excluded from any disclosure within the 24-hour rule that we have for other disclosures. So it, in the spirit of this original bill of more transparency and, you know, providing a little more clarity on who is participating and the size of their participation, this seems like it is, on one hand, I appreciate the intent that small groups would be simplified in their requirements. I'm not sure that a $5,000 a year group that can do $10,000 at the end of the day, to me, is a group that shouldn't be providing a little more reporting. So at the moment, I would not support the amendment. I like the approach, but I'm wondering what a small group really is, whether that would be, you know, $2,000 in an election cycle. That to me would be a small group that I'd, you know, maybe want to support doing a few signs and some things. I'm not clear that this to me is a small group. I'm not clear that I would want to let a group of the size that could be participating under this be able to drop some surprising ads or other mailers in the last couple of days and not be disclosing that for us to see. So I'm reluctant, although I appreciate the intent of trying to provide small groups and groups of people a way to participate in a way. But the whole spirit of this bill was to tone down the amount of large donations and groups that are hiding behind the ability to have large caps. So I'd like to steer away from this.
Representative Hemshute.
Chair Carrick, I'm sorry, I just now noticed page 3 of the amendment. And does it not say exactly what I would like, which is L does not apply if you're bringing in less than $5,000 a year, and L is all of this now I can't find L. No, I'm sorry, it is L. But the requirements under B, which starts on page 2, line 19, don't apply if you're bringing in under $5,000. So you don't have to do the 24 hours. So the process is simplified in this amendment. Am I misunderstanding that?
Representative McKay. Your wife does your APOC, and
yeah,
it's legal a little, does your
yeah,
amendments,
yeah, so,
and we're just in a pickle.
As I said, I didn't write this amendment, so it is a long way around doing exactly, I believe, and through the chair, sorry, Chair Carrick, but it's a long way around, I think, doing what you're doing. As far as addressing the group definition, the group is defined by the amount of money. So it could be 100 people, but if they're less than five, if they collect less than $5,000 in a year, they're considered a small group.
And now, thank you, Representative Hemshute, because now I'm totally confused. And so does that mean that the small groups are exempted from the reporting requirements because of Section 10?
Yes.
So I'm going to ask bill sponsor, Representative Shragi, to weigh in.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Carrick, and to the Chair, Representative Shragi, for the record. My reading of this amendment is that, so as is the case today, folks are required to report contributions that exceed $250 within 9 days of the election so that we have transparency on money being dumped into an election there in that final period of the election. However, Section 10 does exempt a group from having to report those larger than $250 donations if they have total contributions less than $5,000 for that year. So it would exempt groups that have not raised more than $5,000 from reporting those large donations in that 9-day period. If I may offer just a couple of thoughts beyond an explanation or my understanding of the amendment. One of the principal concerns that I have is what happens if a group accepts a $5,000 and first or a penny over the $5,000, but they have already received a number of $250 donations in that period just prior to that election. Do you now have to go back and retroactively report all of those donations more than $250? And do we meet the intent of the statutes that we have today now if just the day before the election you hit that $5,001 threshold and now you're reporting all of the last 9 days worth of contributions, which could be the entirety of that $5,000, and there's no reporting until right when that penny, that $5,000 hits that account, if that makes sense.
So
hold on. Representative Vance first was in the queue.
Well, I have an answer to that, but
I think the committee has clarified that Section 8 on page 2 and Section 10 are what's tied together. That has been clarified. But this is, it's reporting is made, but it's, there's reporting made that we are required to do, but it's within that 24-hour threshold, right? And that has been expressed. I know that members have said they were in areas of the state where they didn't have cell reception. They got a contribution, and they were up, I think, up in your district, and they did not have reception, and they're driving and driving. And because they didn't, they had a $250 contribution, and because they didn't get that report within that 24-hour window, they were fined by APOC for the amount that the contribution was. And they were saying we have to make some kind of exception to that because we have areas that you're traveling, you're campaigning, you're hitting the trail, but then you don't have a way to upload that report. And I don't know about you, but there's some definite dead zones out there. And when we're talking about these smaller groups that are just trying to get their voice out there, I think we need to have a little bit of grace that says, you're going to report, you're gonna be known, but this is saying, hey, we're not going to come down hard on you when you're just a small group of citizens having to report within that 24-hour window. Yes, they still have to make a report. We have 10-day reports. We have the report directly after the election. This is narrow to that window of that 24 hours that so many people get tripped up on.
Representative McCabe.
So thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sharkey, I think the answer is, you know, we already have limits of amount of money that we can accept. I've run up against that limit, and somebody gave me a check, and I said, I'm sorry, I'm at my limit. I can't do this. So it's incumbent on us as candidates or the owners of the small group to say, wait a minute, I'm at my $5,000 limit. I want to remain a small group, so I have to refuse your $250 and one penny contribution or whatever would that took you over $5,000. I mean, that would seem to be evident that it's incumbent on whoever's managing that to say, sorry. And we all know when we're getting close to the limit, the amount of money we can get from a party or something, I think it's $5,000 or $10,000. And I knew when I was getting close to the limit, I just said, I can't take this, you know. Or somebody gives you $100 and they gave you $5 a week ago. You have to be able to say, sorry, can't take it because it's cash and it's over $100. So,
any additional discussion? Okay. Seeing none, I'm going to maintain my objection. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Holland.
No.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Hemshute.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Chair Carrick.
No.
4 yea, 3 nay.
The vote of 4 yeas and 3 nays. Amendment number 2 has passed. So that will bring us to amendment number 3, also known as A.5. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to offer amendment 3 at this time. I think I'll save that for the floor.
Just to be clear, Representative McCabe, you're not offering that in this committee?
In this committee. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, that brings us to amendment number 4, also known as A.7. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment 4, A.7.
Object for discussion. Representative McCabe.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. This amendment sets timelines for APOC to investigate and resolve administrative complaints and requires regular status updates to complainants. The idea of this amendment is to make government work faster for Alaskans. I believe government should be efficient and responsive, not slow-moving bureaucracy. It forces APOC to investigate complaints within 90 days and hold hearings within 45 days of a response, cutting through the red tape so that Alaskans get their answers fast. If you think this overburdens the commission, I say if you're tasked with overseeing elections, you should be able to handle a deadline as efficiently as possible, and certainly before the next election season starts. By setting strict timelines, 90 days for investigations, 45 days to a hearing, and 10 days to a ruling, this amendment ensures candidates who break campaign rules face swift consequences, not endless delays. The requirement for APOC to update complainants every 10 days after 50 days keeps Alaskans in the loop, not left wondering what's happening with their concerns. Keeping citizens informed isn't a burden. It's the job. They could put it online. Citizens can go look online and find out where their complaint is. Too often campaign violations get buried in a drawn-out process, letting bad actors off the hook until after the votes are counted. This amendment puts an end to that. 90 days max for an investigation means justice moves faster than election day. This isn't about piling on rules. It's about making the system work better with clear deadlines, with smarter government. We want this amendment. This amendment trims the fat from APOC's process without adding bureaucracy. It empowers Alaskans to keep elections clean. By giving complainants regular updates, this amendment puts power back in the hands of citizens who call out violations. This amendment is about results, fast investigations, quick hearings, and real transparency for Alaskans. I'd rather push a law that demands action and face a challenge from the courts than let slow government undermine our trust. I think Alaska deserves an APOC system that works, both Alaskans and candidates. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Is there discussion on amendment number 4? Vice Chair Story?
Yes, I'd like to hear from the bill sponsor.
Chair Carrick, thank you. Through the chair to Representative Story, I support what this amendment is trying to do. My concern is that I believe this is generally about the time frame in which there is notification provided in most instances, but I'd like to hear from APOC. My primary concern is really that this would require potentially additional staff and or a fiscal note, and part of the intent is to keep this as closely mirroring the ballot initiative as possible, just trying to mirror what voters are expecting through the initiative process. But I do support the underlying motivation behind this amendment. So I'd like to hear from APOC if we could.
Let's go ahead and do that. Ms. Hebden, would you please comment on this amendment?
To the chair, yes. Currently, under our procedural regulations, APOC staff must notify our respondent that a complaint has been accepted within 7 days of the complaint filing. The respondent is then able to file a response to that complaint within 15 days, and staff is supposed to complete an investigation of the complaint and issue its report within 30 days. So conceivably, this all fits into the 90-day framework that the amendment sets forth. But if it is also contemplating holding the hearing on that investigation report, that could be troublesome in that our commission typically holds 3 regular meetings in a year. If the matter is not expedited, it's typically set aside and considered at the next regular meeting. And then we have 3 positions here that oversee campaign finance disclosure. And at any time, if those positions are vacant, it significantly hinders the ability of the agency to conduct these investigations. So that's really all I have to say about that. I think that the 90 days is doable, provided we're adequately staffed.
Follow-up?
Can you give me history of your staffing? And if you have been at full staff?
Through the chair.
Over the last 3 years, say.
Over the last 3 years, we've experienced significant turnover in our campaign disclosure staff. So we had a campaign disclosure coordinator that had significant time with the agency who retired. I believe that was February of 2021. We had 2 more people come in after that who have since resigned after the 2022 state election. And we are currently down 2 members at the moment. It's a steady and heavy workload, and there's a fairly significant learning curve involved when you're dealing with campaign disclosure.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. I have a question as well. So right now, if there's a complaint and an investigation and fines involved, do the fines continue to pile up on a daily basis until APOC meets to be able to consider taking action?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, no, they do not. The penalties are told as soon as the complaint is filed.
Follow up. So once the complaint's filed, what's the timeline on the action taken by APOC?
So the chair, Representative Vance, once a complaint is filed, staff has to accept it within 7 days and notify the respondent. The respondent has 15 days to respond to the complaint, and staff is supposed to complete an investigation within 30 days.
Thank you. I support this amendment. I've heard a lot of stories about people having this long delay, and it's no reflection on the people working in APOC. They do a lot. However, you know, I think just knowing that there's a timeline of boundaries kind of helps with the anxiety of what's going to happen if a complaint's been filed. So I support this amendment.
I have a follow-up question based on what Ms. Hebden said for the amendment sponsor. Would it be your intention to have the investigations completed within the 90-day time frame, responding to what she had mentioned about the three meetings taking place a year for APOC?
Thanks, Chair Carrick. So I'm a little confused at the I'm a little confused at the supposed to language that she said, supposed to have a complaint done within 30 days. I know personally that there's two of them that are well over 90 days that haven't even begun investigated. I'm also a little confused. There's 24 complaints, I think, last year. So I'm unclear the number. Maybe it's just the complaints that have been accepted. And I'm also a little confused about, does every complaint, and maybe this is a question for Ms. Hebden, does every complaint have to be heard by the commission itself, or only those complaints that are accepted? And maybe it's the complaints that are not accepted that take up the investigation time and are not heard by the full commission. But 24 complaints doesn't seem like an inordinate workload, so I'm a little... and that's just what's online. I'm a little bit confused by some of Ms. Hebden's answers.
For the chair, was there a question here?
maybe not, Ms. Hebden. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, maybe I'll clarify the question. The real question was, how many complaints did you have last year? And do you only list on your website the complaints that have to go to the commission that meets only three times a year?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, there were 13 complaints that were filed in 2024. The complaints that are accepted and investigated all go to the commission. They are... our final decision makers and just about everything that staff does.
Follow up. Thank you. So, Ms. Hebden, so what I think I hear you saying is the commission meets three times a year. You only have 13 complaints last year, and the staff investigates them and then just waits for the commission to meet. So it could be 3 months or 90 days before... or maybe even more before a complaint actually goes in front of the commission. Is that sound right? Am I right on that?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, yes, depending on the timing of when an investigation is completed and the staff report is issued, it can be months before it is actually considered at a commission meeting.
Thank you.
Representative Shragi, I keep wanting to call you Chair Shragi.
I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, maybe to APOC, would that mean that – so I view this amendment, and no offense is meant at all by this, but just in reading it, it seems redundant with the other timelines or deadlines listed in this section. Is it my understanding, just based on what we've heard, that we're already in violation of the timeline? I'm reading here, the commission shall hold a hearing on the complaint not later than 40 days after the respondent's written response is due, not later than 10 days after the hearing. The commission shall issue its order. Are we already in violation of the timeline in statute, spelled out in statute? And, I mean, maybe this gets me to a yes on this amendment if it's just another deadline that is kind of a target for them with no penalty if they violate it. But could APOC weigh in on that issue on the timeline?
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, essentially, yes. For the timeline that you are speaking to as far as the commission shall hold a hearing on the complaint not later than 45 days after the respondent's written response, yes, I would say at least 80% of our complaint hearings would be in violation of that provision.
If I may follow up, Chair Carrick, I guess to the chair, you know, that makes me somewhat indifferent on this amendment. I think APOC has some serious constraints on their ability to meet the deadlines that are already in statute. Whether or not it's helpful to reiterate that there's a 90-day deadline, I guess I see it as somewhat harmless. At the same time, you could make the case that if it's harmless, then is it necessary to add it? I don't know. I guess I'm split on this issue.
Yeah, I would concur. I sort of like setting an additional target, and so I agree with the substance of this amendment. And Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Maybe I could ask one more question, Chair Carrick. So, Ms. Hebden, how many complaints right now do you have that are in queue that are over 90 days?
Through the Chair, Representative McCabe, I don't know off the top of my head. I believe 8, but I'm not positive.
So you have eight complaints right now where the complainants or the
follow-up.
So you have 8 complaints right now that are over 90 days that the complainants and the targets of the complaint or the plaintiffs, if you will, or defendants don't know what the status is?
For the chair, Representative McCabe, that is correct.
Thank you.
I will also preface that by saying leading up to the election and after the election is our busiest time of the year, and it is also this particular election season when our two campaign disclosure staff left. So, I mean, the election season is the busiest time of the year for us on any given year. So it's not uncommon to receive a flurry of complaints leading up to the general election and following the general election.
Thank you.
So at this time, I'm going to remove my objection to amendment number 4, also known as A.7. Is there any additional objection? Seeing none, amendment number 4 is adopted. And that will bring us to amendment number 5, also known as A.8. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment 5, which is A.8.
Thank you, and I'll object for discussion. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this one is a particularly interesting one, and it will probably take a while to debate and understand. What this does is shine a light on big money influence. I believe in transparency and accountability in government. This amendment forces candidates to disclose who is bundling big contributions over $10,000, showing voters exactly who's trying to sway our elections with aggregated cash. This is not about banning speech. It's about letting Alaskans see the players behind the scenes. Knowledge is power, and this gives the voters the tools to judge candidates for themselves. It allows Alaskans to see who actually is speaking. This empowers Alaskans over insiders. So bundlers are those who round up thousands of dollars from their networks. They often wield outside influence. And by requiring disclosure, we level the playing field so regular Alaskans, not just insiders, know who's pulling the strings. If a lawyer claims this chills free speech, I say tough. The First Amendment doesn't protect secrecy for political kingmakers using a group for protection. It protects the public's right to know. And I happen to know there is at least one issue out there where a bundler refused to disclose who he got money from. When someone bundles $10,000 plus for a candidate, it raises eyebrows, especially if it's hidden. This amendment drags that into the daylight, cutting down on perception of shady deals that erode the trust in our elections. Unlike heavy-handed bans or caps, this amendment doesn't limit contributions. It just demands honesty and transparency. Less government overreach, more sunlight. Candidates still get their funds. Voters just get the facts. Bundlers can come from anywhere. Too often they're channeling out-of-state money into our races, and we don't know about it. This amendment lets Alaskans see if non-residents are using a middleman to pump cash into our elections, keeping our state's future in local hands. We must demand accountability from our leaders. If a candidate's raking in bundled cash, they should own it. Name the bundlers and face the voters. This amendment makes sure no one can dodge responsibility for who's bankrolling them. Some might say this burdens free association, but that's nonsense. It's not about stopping bundling. It's just about making it public. If you're proud of your support, you shouldn't mind the spotlight, right? This amendment puts Alaskans ahead of special interests. If the courts balk, claiming it's too tough on donors' rights, we should fight back. We need to know. It's just about transparency. It's not about limiting their rights. I think I'll stop there, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any additional discussion on Amendment Number 5? And I'll actually ask the bill sponsor, Representative Schrage.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. To the chair, my understanding is this is already illegal. When I go to make a donation to a campaign, it says that you are making the donation for yourself with your own money, and it is already prohibited in state statute for you to make a contribution on behalf of someone else or to collect or aggregate money for the purpose of making a contribution. So in this instance, I think the amendment may make things less clear. And I think the intent is already met through statute. I'm thankful that is already in statute, because I, like Representative McCabe, do not want individuals bundling or aggregating donations for a candidate.
Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So maybe I could ask Ms. Hebden a question, if you wouldn't mind, Chair Carrick. Ms. Hebden, is there anybody now, big group, in Alaska or even outside of Alaska, that has refused to answer your question or AIPOC's question of who actually contributed to them to make a contribution to a ballot measure or to a candidate?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I guess a simple answer would be yes. In the past, there have been outside organizations who have essentially refused to disclose the source of their funding, but they aren't contributing directly to a candidate's campaign either. I'm not aware of that particular issue when it comes to a candidate campaign.
Follow up. Thank you, Ms. Hebden. So what we're talking about here is an independent expenditure group, I am sure. And I believe AIPOC asked them who contributed the money, and they said that they didn't have to answer. Is that basically refused to answer your question? Do I have that right, or is that not right?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I'm sorry, I don't recall specifically if it was they refused to provide their contributors. They failed to provide information that was subpoenaed by the commission, but I can't recall off the top of my head the specific information that we had requested.
Thank you.
It concerned an investigation, though, and I don't know that it was specific to their contributors.
Any additional discussion on amendment number 5? Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. If Mr. Bullard is still online, could he just confirm for us what Representative Shragi said, that this is already illegal?
Yes, we can ask that question. Mr. Bullard, were you able to hear that discussion and potentially weigh in?
Good afternoon, members of the committee, through the chair. This is Alpheus Bullard of Pledge Legal. I believe I was able to hear Representative Shragi's statement. This is currently prohibited. Well, it's prohibited to give in the name of another. This bundling amendment may apply to a category of contribution that isn't presented as someone else's, but is, I would say, organized by a bundler and may address contributions that are made in state elections that are not currently spoken to by our limitations and prohibitions.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bullard, I just want to make sure I understand. So bundling is prohibited by statute. However, this amendment addresses something that is not currently in statute?
Through the chair, once again, this is Alpheus Bullard of Budge Legal. Bundling is not prohibited right now. Our current statutes do not speak to bundled contributions as they're defined in this amendment as subsection B.
Could I make a comment?
Yes, Ms. Hebden.
Currently under statute, the only persons that are authorized to receive contributions are the candidate themselves or treasurer or deputy treasurer of the campaign. So I do think that the concept of this bundling is prohibited.
Is there additional discussion? I will say I think there is a need for some clarification again with some of the parties at play here about whether this language is simply duplicative or whether it's adding something new. This is also a title change amendment, and again, my intention as the chair is to see the legislation move forward and not become overly complicated. And this amendment introduces a concept that is either covered or is whole cloth something new that we're not doing right now. And I'm going to maintain my objection on this amendment based on those concerns. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I have about, I don't know, 10 pages worth of description of bundling and bundlers and how much of a big problem it's becoming in other states. So currently, anybody can accept donations from anybody and say, this came from me. So Kevin McCabe, I get donations from all my neighbors of $90 in cash each, say, and I take them to put down on an independent expenditure group to put down to pay for flyers, to pay for whatever, and I don't have to report anything other than I did this money. Nobody else has to report. I don't have to say I got the money from XYZ. And frankly, there are cases where the bundlers have had tens of millions of dollars donated to them, are given to them to put down on a candidate, and the only person that has to put their name down is the bundler, not the people that contributed to him. So it's using a third party, essentially, and as Mr. Bullard said, it's not currently prohibited in statute, which is why we decided to do this. So it's a huge and getting bigger problem, and so title change in this body is not that big a deal. But
well, Rep. McCabe, I do have a question to that. Are you suggesting that the candidate is a bundler under this?
No, absolutely not. But if you have Smith as a candidate and Jones is the guy that's going to donate to him, Jones can collect money from anybody he wants right now. He could collect money from 100 different people, $1,000 a piece, and give it to the candidate and say, here's a donation from Jones, and he doesn't have to report who gave him the money. So it's using a third party as a middleman or as a go-between.
I don't think that's what we heard from AIPAC. Representative Shragi, do you want to weigh in?
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair to the committee, I guess. I think I heard Representative McCabe talk about collecting those donations for an independent expenditure, but that independent expenditure cannot give directly to a candidate. If they're giving directly to a candidate, then they can't go and collect donations to be able to funnel to the candidate, because as we heard from AIPAC, the only person able to receive a donation is the candidate. If you're going to be fundraising for the purpose of influencing that election, you need to be registered as a group to be able to do that. So I'm quite confident that bundling, as described by this amendment, is in fact already prohibited, with, again, the caveat that IE rules are somewhat different but also outside the scope of what we're dealing with here.
So through the chair follow-up, I may have said IE, and I apologize if I did, but I think this is specific to a candidate, and as you heard, we depended on lawyers when we said no to Amendment 1, and now we're not going to depend on the lawyer who says that it's not currently allowed in statute. I don't know. I'm confused again.
Well, I'm hesitant to adopt any amendment that we're very confused on, so I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from. Is there any additional discussion on Amendment Number 5? Seeing none, my objection is maintained. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Representative Hemshoot.
No.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Representative Holland isn't here. Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Lastly, Chair Carrick.
No.
3 yea, 3 nay.
So with a vote of 3 yeas, 3 nays, Amendment Number 5, also known as A.8, is not adopted. This brings us to Amendment Number 6, also known as A.9. Representative McCabe.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to offer Amendment 6 or Amendment 7 in this committee.
Okay. At this time.
No, in this committee.
I know. I've just... thank you for the clarification. Catching Representative Moore up to speed, we did take up Amendment Number 8, which is also known as A.15, at the start of committee today. So we will skip ahead to Amendment Number 9, also known as A.16. I'm going to move my amendment and object for discussion just very briefly, and then I will be withdrawing this amendment. This amendment has some constitutional concerns related to freedom of speech for the individual who is a candidate in a race, but would have limited the amount that a candidate might give to their own campaign. The limit is $6,000 per election cycle in this amendment, which would have been three times more than the individual contribution limit established in the underlying bill. We have seen in my region, for sure, and in other regions around the state, candidates who have been personally wealthy dump thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars into their own campaigns, which can seriously impact the outcome of especially a local election or a small state house election. Our elections sometimes are only a, you know, $40,000 to $50,000 races in most cases. So they're not high dollar by the standards of even the rest of the state or certainly not the country. I feel that this is a major barrier to younger people who would like to serve in office and who are not personally wealthy or don't have parents or spouses who are independently wealthy. And I personally experienced this in my first primary race. I had an opponent with quadruple the funds that I had available pre-primary in the race. And so while I am withdrawing the amendment today, I did just want to draw attention, as we've had a lot of good discussion in this committee today about extenuating challenges for candidates, for groups and non-group entities. And I think it's valuable to bring up that this will continue to potentially represent a barrier to new candidates or younger candidates that would like to serve in office or those who aren't independently wealthy. And I just appreciate the committee's indulgence for me offering a couple of comments on that as we move forward. Any additional comments? Representative Vance?
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Well, I think the point that you're here proves that that the money was not a limitation. You know, as I mentioned before, I was not as young as you. However, I was under 40 when I first got elected, and I did not contribute any of my own money to the campaign. In fact, I think the only personal money that we have contributed to any of my campaigns has maybe come in like lumber that my husband picked up, you know, to go provide a few things, and we did report that. However, you know, I feel that money does help, obviously, to get started on a campaign. However, it is in no way a limitation because engaging with the public is the most important. So I don't want people who are looking to run as a candidate to feel that they are limited simply because they don't have the money to put into their own campaign. It's completely doable, and understand the concern. However, I don't feel that it is a limitation.
Thank you for those comments. I appreciate the hard work that you and I both had to put in our first races. I think the story that you mentioned the other day was extremely, felt close to home for me too. And I would say that the money in the race that I had was a huge impact on the challenge that race presented that may not have otherwise been the case. And I think the campaign contribution limits underlying legislation here goes back to this idea that candidates should have as a goal and the public would like to have as a goal, that if you're going to have a lot of money in a race, that you're getting it from a wider breadth of people. And that was, I think, what impacted my ability in my race and many other younger candidates I've talked to who have had to really hit the streets to overcome some of those challenges. Regardless, I appreciate the committee's indulgence. It's been a long day. I am withdrawing Amendment Number 9, also known as A.16, and thank you all for consideration. That will bring us now to Amendment Number 10, which is also known as A.17. Representative Vance.
I move Amendment Number 10.
And I'll object for discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment adds a requirement that groups supporting or opposing candidates or ballot measures in our state elections must maintain a physical address in Alaska or designate a registered agent with a physical address here before spending funds in our elections. This concept aligns with our existing corporate statutes requiring entities to continuously maintain a registered agent or a registered office in Alaska, ensuring a point of accountability within the state. Specifically, it accomplishes three key steps: the new address agent requirement, agent qualifications, and registration with APOC. It ensures that entities participating in our election process have a clear and enforceable presence in Alaska. It means better transparency, more straightforward enforcement of campaign finance laws, and greater clarity for the public regarding who is funding our elections. By placing this responsibility in organizations that spend money in our elections, we strengthen accountability measures. We make it easier for APOC to contact or serve notices to these groups, and we deter the use of purely virtual out-of-state offices, enhancing our ability to investigate complaints or irregularities if they arise. So currently, Nevada, Colorado, and Maryland require in-state, and then New York requires that they have a registered bank within the state for their campaign funds. So it mirrors the established, in short, it mirrors the established corporations, standards for corporations operating in the state, which is essentially a large group, requiring a continuous presence, and applies the same principle for those who wish to influence our elections.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I will first look to the bill sponsor to comment on Amendment Number 10.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Carrick, to the chair on Amendment Number 10. So this is one of the amendments that has been flagged as having constitutional concerns. I will say one of the things I've learned through carrying this bill in prior legislatures is that just because another state has a policy does not make it legally valid. And I bring this up only to say that I understand there were examples of other states that have such a requirement. I don't know that any of those have been tested in court. So I can't speak with a great deal of certainty to this amendment, but I know that it's, in my view, generally better to look at the court rulings and making sure that any new laws we pass conform to the court ruling as opposed to looking at what may be done in other states as an example of what may be acceptable here, because in many cases what other states have done has not been challenged and scrutinized according to that legal standard laid out by the Supreme Court. But it may be of the committee's interest to speak with Ledge Legal on this amendment to hear their view on any constitutional concerns with this amendment.
Let's go ahead and do that. Mr. Buller, did you hear that discussion, and can you provide some comment?
Good afternoon. Good evening, members of the Trust Community and Regional Affairs Committee. This is Office Buller of Ledge Legal. I was fortunate enough to be able to hear the conversation. I don't know that this raises any constitutional issues. This is a provision that requires disclosure, doesn't limit contributions or expenditures. It just requires additional disclosures. In the context of this legislation, if it raises a constitutional issue, it would be one of single subject.
Chair Carrick, I stand corrected. Thank you very much to Mr. Bullard. Thank you.
I was going to offer comment that I really like this amendment, so unless there's a significant constitutional concern, I think it's a reasonable restriction. I would like to remove my objection. Is there additional objection on Amendment Number 10? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment Number 10, also known as A.17, is adopted. And that brings us to Amendment Number 11, also known as A.18, Representative Vance.
I move Amendment 11.
Object, Representative Vance.
So this amendment targets the statute addressing contribution and expenditures by foreign influence corporations and foreign nationals in our state elections. Currently, subsections B and C of the provision carve out certain exemptions, essentially allowing foreign influence corporations to engage in election-related spending under specific circumstances permitted by federal law or through segregated account. So in combing through our election law, it's amazing what you will find. So it deletes two subsections, tightening the law to ensure that foreign influence corporations and foreign nationals remain prohibited from making contributions or expenditures in connections with Alaska's state or local elections. By removing these exemptions, we eliminate any ambiguity that foreign influence corporations could circumvent Alaska's campaign finance restrictions through segregated accounts or by relying on broader allowances of federal law. And we also reinforce our sovereign interest in safeguarding elections from foreign influence or interference, complementing what federal rules already prohibit. By repealing these two sections, the statute reaffirms a more comprehensive prohibition on foreign corporate involvement in state elections, putting Alaska on a stronger footing to protect the integrity of our democratic processes. I believe this strengthens our campaign finance laws by providing clarity and maintaining a consistent standard. If you're a foreign influence corporation or foreign national, you cannot fund state campaign activity, no exceptions. So I appreciate the consideration of this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. So if a billionaire offered an incentive to vote, a lottery, that if you vote, you could win $1 million, that would not be allowed because of this, if that billionaire were not a U.S. citizen.
Through the chair to Representative Hemshute, my shorthand, my non-legal answer would be yes, but I think having clarification from Altheus would be helpful. But what we found out is by looking at these statutes is that our statute kind of pointed to federal law, but then we saw that these exemptions allowed like a separate bank account that you could accept foreign money. So it's like this little loophole that is existing to be able to allow this. So our statute points to whatever the federal limit is. And I think Alaskans are feeling pretty strongly that we don't want people who are not in our country to be influencing us. And I know that based upon our previous data breaches, that there are other countries who have tried to influence our elections. And this is just trying to close that loophole, make it very clear about how we feel about foreign influence.
Follow up?
Trying to digest it. Thanks.
I'm going to look to the bill sponsor for a comment, Representative Shragi.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair to the committee, I don't think that I have any objection to this amendment, assuming there aren't legal concerns with its structure, but I think that it's reasonable and very much in support of Alaskans determining the results of our elections here. We might not be able to limit out-of-state donations, but I think that this may be a positive step forward. I might ask Ledge Legal to just quickly weigh in to make sure that there are not concerns with this amendment.
Let's go ahead and do that. Mr. Bowler, did you hear that discussion, and can you provide comment?
Good evening. This is Alfie Bowler of Budge Legal, and I did hear the question. I guess my concern would be one of federal supremacy, that right now subsection B of 153068 provides that we're not doing anything in state law that would be found to conflict with federal law. And in this case, when it comes to dealing with foreign nationals, you know, it's the federal government which really gets to call the shots. And so B prevented this from being interpreted in such a way that it would go beyond what federal law allows the state to do. That may be desirable or undesirable for the members of the committee. But that was something that subsection B did. This is a complex area of law when it comes to subsection C and what corporations are defined as foreign-influenced corporations. I don't know that preventing this raises any constitutional issues.
Clear as mud. Representative Vance.
Chair Carrick, I think my staffer, Bob Ballinger, would be able to provide some clarification to this amendment if that's helpful for the committee.
I will go ahead and allow it. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Ballinger. If you could come forward and offer a bit of additional context.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Ballinger, Representative Vance's office. And I don't think that Atheus was wrong on that, maybe just not as clear as it could have been. The provision B does two things. It does say that you can't go any further than federal law as far as limitations, but it also says that it is basically our limitation is federal law. So essentially, if federal law were to change, somebody passed a statute, then so would state law. The truth is Alaska state law can't go any further than what the prohibitions or limitations are of the federal constitution. So we're bound by that no matter what. So in this case, we aren't specifically, there's sometimes a state will pass a law that is in conflict with federal jurisprudence. And there was talk about that with some of the amendments that were offered is do they do that? This doesn't do this. This just takes out a provision that says, hey, Alaska law is going to be bound by U.S. law, whatever direction it goes. And so it takes that out. If later on you pass a law that was in direct conflict with a federal or a foreign national making campaign contributions, that would be a problem. But this bill wouldn't do that.
Okay. I am not seeing any additional committee discussion. Vice Chair Story.
Just a comment. I still am somewhat confused, and so usually when I'm confused, I do not want to have anything move forward at that point to the amendment. So that's kind of how I'm feeling right now.
Okay. Representative Holland and then Himshute.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, just want to note, I pulled out and, you know, this main section is basically saying that foreign corporations and entities can't be contributing and getting mixed up in our elections. That's the header part of this whole thing. The following sections B and C provide a few little carve-outs from that tied to federal law, but the header for this is we don't want federal entities to be involved in making contributions. So I'm comfortable moving ahead with this amendment from the standpoint that the header remains. All we're doing here is pulling out a couple of those exceptions that might have allowed somebody to work within some federal guidelines that might be less, but the spirit and intent here has not changed, and I'm comfortable with it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Himshute.
I think I'm good. Thanks.
Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Holland, for that. I'm less confused, so I appreciate that, those clarifications.
Okay, seeing no additional committee discussion, I am removing my objection on amendment number 11. Is there additional objection? Seeing none, amendment number 11, also known as A.18, is adopted. And that gets us through the core of the amendment process on House Bill 16.
Chair
although
Carrick.
I do know I have a motion from Representative Himshute.
I apologize. I'm going to be the most unpopular person in the building, but I'd like to move to rescind action on Amendment 2.
Is there objection? Seeing none, Amendment number 2 has been rescinded, also known as A.4. I believe at this time, well, very brief at ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. So as a quick recap, amendment number 2, also known as A.4, was rescinded and will not be offered. Which brings us back to House Bill 16 as amended. Thank you to the committee for having a very robust conversation today, to our APOC folks and Ledge Legal for helping answer questions. I am going to, at this time, look to Vice Chair Story for a motion.
I move that House Bill 16, also known as 34-LS0217-A, be moved from the House State Affairs Committee as amended, with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Checked.
There is an objection. Would you like to speak to your objection? I also heard objection from Rep. Vance. Would you like to speak to your objection?
Yes, thank you. And I appreciate the work on this and the consideration of these various amendments. There's so many areas of concern when it comes to our campaign finance laws by Alaskans, and it takes great deliberation. However, in looking at just the whole idea of limiting campaign contributions, I feel that we should not limit campaign free speech. The reasons that the court said that we had to, if we were going to make changes, that we had to prove a compelling reason to limit that free speech and had to prove the connection to corruption. We have gone through a campaign cycle with no limits on campaign contributions, and I have heard no complaints of corruption by an undue influence on any member. I think that our districts are unique across the state of Alaska, and it will be the voters who will provide the accountability with that candidate if they feel that one candidate is receiving undue influence by large contributions. Where we have rural districts, or maybe some of the downtown Anchorage districts that have a lower median threshold than another side of Anchorage, you know, they're going to have a different expectation about the campaign contributions that their candidate receives than across town, just because the income level is different and the expectation that we have. So I feel that limiting that free speech has, in this bill, has not met the court's compelling reason to be able to make that limitation. So I will be voting no on that measure, not due to any of the work that's been done or anything like that, because I appreciate the deliberation. However, it's just the overall idea that we're limiting people's ability to speak up on this issue. I have people who don't have much money, but they volunteer. They make phone calls, and they go out and are willing to put up signs. And they tell me, man, Sarah, I feel so bad. I don't have but maybe $5 to give to you. And I said, you know what? Your time to me is invaluable. I can't replace that. And then I have people who will make larger contributions that say, Sarah, I don't got any time, but I can give you my money. And you can't weigh one more than the other. And I think we need to make that a consideration as well, because when it comes to free speech, it comes in many forms. And I think that's the statement that the courts have said, is that this is political free speech, and that can come by means of money or action. And so by that principle, I'm going to be voting no on this bill today.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So one of the things that we discussed is the whole corruption idea, especially with respect to an outside money independent expenditure group. So here you have a candidate that doesn't have much money, and he is running, and an IE has $5 or $6 million to put against him, and they blatantly lie with postcards and internet ads. And they just lie about him. Maybe they don't even know him, or maybe he's an incumbent and they lie about the way he voted. And he doesn't have enough money to sue them for corruption or for libel or to go after them in any means. It's up to us as a committee to direct APOC to do what they're doing. It's not up to the courts. And frankly, this whole corruption thing, that you have to prove corruption, I can give you example after example after example just in my race of the corruption that was created by independent expenditure groups. And I think it's crap that we are just bowing to the courts because of some rule that they put out, and they have no idea what goes on in Alaska with outside money and outside independent expenditure groups. And frankly, if I had to offer a conceptual amendment, it would be to do away with APOC completely and to go with the FEC. So that's my feelings.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Additional comments? Seeing none. Thank you all for the robust debate today. I sense that the objection is maintained. Will the clerk please call the roll on House Bill 16?
Representative Moore.
Pass.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative Holland.
Yes.
Representative Vance.
No.
Representative Himshute.
Yes.
Representative Story.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
Yes.
Chair Carrick.
Yes.
5 yea, 2 nay.
And on a vote of 5 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 16 is moved from the State Affairs Committee. We will pass around the paperwork as soon as we've adjourned. And that does conclude House State Affairs today. Thank you very much to the committee members, including Rep. Moore, for sticking around.
Safe travels.
Very much appreciated. And to our folks who were able to answer questions today. Our next meeting is going to be on Tuesday, April 15th at 3:15 here in room 120. As a reminder to committee members, next week we will not be meeting on Thursday, so that will be our meeting for next week. At that hearing, we will have confirmation hearings for appointees to the following boards and commissions: the Alaska Public Offices Commission. That should be fun. And the Alaska Police Standards Council. Additionally, we will be hearing three bills: House Bill 104 on address confidentiality from Representative Mears, HCR 2, a uniform rules abstention change, also from Representative Mears. And then we will be taking up as well House Bill 1 on gold and silver specie from Representative McCabe. With no further business before the committee, we are adjourned at 6:05 p.m.